This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 339 of the Outlander podcast. I am still Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Announcements?
Droughtlander. Just Droughtlander.
That's true. It's going to be long. It's going to be really long.
It's now.
This episode, we'd like to thank our co-producer, Linda B. Thank you so much, Linda B., for your support. And this episode is sponsored by Best Fiends. We are so excited to share our new read-along theme music. It is once again by TV film composer Dallas Crane. And in subsequent sharings of this, we will share all of the different versions and bugle calls that Dallas shared with us, Everett Kelly on bugle, and Derek and Jackie Crane on fifes. Find out more about Dallas and his music at dallascrane.com and follow him on Twitter. That's at DallasCrane.
And now, on to our read-along! It's been a while since I've done that, though not as long as it's been. Only 13 weeks, I guess, since I've done that.
Yeah, about, huh?
When you think about it. This week, we will be beginning our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along. We're going to start with a prologue.
So, this is almost short enough that I could read it. I won't, but it's basically, if you have never read this book, which a lot of you maybe haven't, you already have heard this prologue. They brought it in almost verbatim to an early-ish episode of season 5, which we just finished, of course. It's that whole, I can't say conversation because it was just one person. It was Claire's VO, but it was the whole VO about how time, quote, time is a lot of things. People say God is. So this is the episode, I forget the number, but the episode we got it in season 5 was where Claire's in the 60s and she's lost the patient to anaphylaxis due to a penicillin allergy. Of course, that's the show only. That's not the book. Mm-hmm. That's not happened in the book. And she goes to perpetual adoration and other things, but it's in that sequence of events, in that episode, that we hear the VO about time and God. Elizabeth Kay writes, I thought the prologue was very familiar when I read it, and then I realized it was because they used it as a voiceover in episode 505, Perpetual Adoration. Claire quotes it almost word for word just after the title screen. I suppose Claire is about as qualified as a person can be to ruminate on the idea of time. I tried to put some thought into the idea of memory being the devil. Memory can definitely tempt us and lie to us. It's been shown many times that memory is not always very accurate. And I suppose if we dwell too much on memory, we forget to actually be present in what is happening now. So I agree with that, Elizabeth Kay. And one thing, I thought about that too when I was reading this, and I thought, you know, I'm not saying she's wrong, but I couldn't think of a specific, blatant, hardcore, I guess, example of how memory might be the devil. But then I thought, you know, remembering things and remembering things that people have done that maybe aren't very good or aren't very nice, that maybe they've worked through or they've been forgiven for someone to bring that up. Of course, that's memory only. For someone to bring that up and potentially damage relationships, I can see how absolutely memory could be akin to the devil. So thanks for sharing those. I was thinking a lot about this prologue too. What did you think about this prologue or the episode?
Well, I was thinking how strange this read-along is going to be, at least like for the first
40 chapters
portion of the book, because because a lot of these things have already been in the show. So it's like my recollection of them as I'm reading them, I'm like, am I remembering this because I read this book before, or am I remembering this because they just did this on the show?
Yeah, I think it'll only, well, I take it back. It's only going to be, it won't only be a problem for the beginning. There's something big and bad and Bonnet toward the very end. And I guess, actually, not even toward the end. You're right. It actually is woven all throughout the book, right? The Bonnet's end is toward the end. Mm-hmm. If for some reason you're not a show watcher, but you are a listener to our read-along, I don't know if that even exists. Sorry, are not a show watcher and only listen to our read-along. If that exists, then I apologize for what I just said. You're going to have to go with it. Anyway, yeah, Summer, I think obviously what you said is right. My qualification that is only the first like 30 or 30-ish chapters, or maybe even like 20-something chapters, that's not true. So stuff happens already.
It's just going to be weird because we spend usually... Because we always read ahead, right? So we're always a book ahead of the show. So it's like starting the read-along with things that they've already done in the show feels weird. And I'm okay. I'm gonna move forward in this, but it's just...
It's also the first time that we will have the opportunity, and I'm not saying it's... I mean, you know, good or bad. It's not bad or good. It just is. And especially now, it's the first time we've ever had to do it. But usually we can keep the books and show... Well, I think we're more successful at keeping the show out of the books than we are keeping the books out of the show. Because when we watch the show, we try and say, you know, oh, well, not to make, unless it's like a total wackadoodle, you know, like I'll say it again. My favorite, quote unquote, I'm being ironic here. My favorite example of a changing character is when Jamie tried to get Fergus to help with cause a mutiny on the boat in Voyager. Well, it wasn't. That's the point. It wasn't Voyager. In season 3. Oh,
so wait, not when he straight up murdered the British soldier in the
hotel? That's Summer's favorite. So anyway, we each have these things. So when something like that happens, obviously, if you listen, we call it out if we believe it's like an abrupt turn from character, because we've been with these characters for over 20 years and many people have been with them longer than we have, and we notice it.
And for good or bad, we've just finished that previous book.
Yeah, so we have a fresh recall. We've lived with them for years and we notice when things, I'm not saying things are wrong, but we notice when they're different and when they're really done well and when it gets us in the gut as like a, you know, for me, a tear prick or something like that. We don't. We have never in 5 read-alongs had to discuss. Well, there is no discussion of how something is handled in the book because the book is canon. So that's not even up for discussion. You may not like it, but it's there. It came before the show. So it's just going to be really interesting this read-along to see not how we discuss it, because I think we've already done the discussion during the episode discussions, but it'll be interesting once we come to a point and we're sticking to the book. One thing we won't be saying is, well, to certain things, I wonder if they'll keep this in the show because we already know some things are kept.
I may be saying that every time
it happens,
they leave it in the show. I'll be like, I wonder if they left this in the show.
So Summer is right. It's going to be an interesting ride. I was wrong when I said it's only like the first 30 chapters. I mean, not every chapter, but certain things are kept in the first 30 chapters. That is not true. It's in the first 30-ish, and then it's toward the end. And then you know what? Because the thing at the end doesn't happen until the end, you have a lot of stuff leading up to that. So it's actually stuff from the whole Ding Dong book. So it is something that we're going to have to be not on our toes for. We're going to notice it. I think it will happen organically. We don't have to lay it out. We don't have to look for it. Since we're very limited on purpose in what we discuss on these episodes, like a chapter or two, or God forbid three, if they're like 1 or 2 page chapters like we had in for this episode. Typically, though, our chapters, our episodes will be discussing one chapter. And that's a very narrow focus, right? And that's good. Number one, it helps us get through Jowlander more easily because we can go more slowly. But yeah, it's not overwhelming in content and normally does not lead to extra, extra long discussions.
All right. And moving right along, we will now be starting part 1 entitled Rumors of War, chapter 1, an interrupted conversation.
In chapter one, there's little to no dialogue here. The dialogue is one-sided. It's a one-sided conversation, verbal conversation anyway, between Ian and God and the rest. And well, Ian and also
and the
Rollo.
Dog.
And Rollo. A lot of description, but mostly action. So, yeah, it's pretty easy to sum up. So we are here with young Ian and Rollo, and he is he's having trouble sleeping. We learn that Ian rarely sleeps at night anymore. And so he's out sleeping rough, out sleeping in the forest. At this moment, we don't know how far he is, where he is. We just know that people are, you know, people are a good group, a good sized group of people, humans, are clangity clickety clangy going by him with a few animals, but we don't know how far he is from the ridge. We don't know where this takes place. I don't think it's said in the book, right? It didn't say where.
It doesn't. But here's my question.
Yeah.
Knowing that we're also going to be discussing chapter two tonight, are we to take away from this that these people that Ian kind of tracks and sees and gets trampled by are the people that burned down the Dutch cabin?
I have, all the years I've read this, I have never put those together. This is a Dumbs of Autumn moment, potentially. I don't know. I never did. I think that's a great question for our listeners. Let's get through this. And then now, oh, great, dang, a lot, now I'm going through my notes with a different, whole different lens. Okay, so we're with young Ian and Rollo. He has trouble sleeping, so he's out and about, but he's not with his people. He's with his dog. It's a moonless night, so it's probably a new moon, or maybe there's, I don't know if he said he saw any, I don't think it's cloudy, though, because he said he could see some things kind of shining in ambient light, maybe, but he doesn't, I don't think Diana writes anything about clouds, but it is dark, and it's moonless, so he hears something, and he knows it's humans. It's not like scurrying birds or scurrying nocturnal animals. Because what helps him identify the fact that it's men is because of the types of noises they're making, and the types of noises they're making also clues him in as to them being white, meaning colonists, right? Meaning non-native, basically. Native Americans, mm-hmm. He says, they're not, you know, magically silent when they walk, but they can be, they're much quieter than this. And what really sets this noise apart that makes him know that it's not Native Americans is that he hears the clang of metal. He hears harnesses and gun barrels, and he hears a lot of them.
Now, if we were comparing this, to this show in the way that they've portrayed the Native Americans, all of the Native Americans have buttons.
Have guns.
And they all seem, buttons.
Oh, buttons.
They all seem
yeah.
to have the soldier coats that they've been, you know,
oh,
repurposed
yeah.
or, you know, gentlemen's coats that all have buttons and belts and things. So that doesn't 100% jive with this sentence, but I don't disagree that they definitely walk differently in a forest for sure, especially. And larger groups, the larger the group is, the more noise they make. I mean, that's just a given. The less there are, the more they kind of listen to nature and pay attention to things. But when you get into a large group, you kind of get that confidence and bravado of no one's going to bother us, so we don't have to be quiet. I mean, especially if there's not actively like a war or they're expecting to be met upon by like other people, right? Or set upon, not met upon.
Yeah, they're not trying to sneak around for some reason.
Yeah.
He also smells dried blood on what he believes are pelts. And so, but he says they're not trappers who move in ones or twos. And this actually made me laugh out loud. I wrote LOL for real. Diana says he counted 23 men. I was like, wait, what? Where do you get 23 from clickety clang to bop from this game, from this gun over here and this harness over here? I thought that was the most random, and first of all, random, and also he is amazing at this game.
He also noticed not one, but two mules.
Diana does not tell us that he's right in the number. He just tells us that he counts 23.
Not only did he notice two mules, but he could tell they were laden and they were carrying a lot of stuff, which is another reason this made me think they were the people from the cabin. Because one, they smell kind of blood, dried blood, right? Which could be pelts, but it also could be that they killed some people. And two, they're laden down with, because the mules are packed heavy with stuff. And when they go to the house that's been burned down, all of the things that are have been taken. Like there's no tools, there's no, none of the, it doesn't say for sure. I'm just saying that was my assumption.
But I think it is an important possibility to keep in mind. And we haven't gotten there yet, but at the Dutch cabin, no one showed any sign of any kind of bloody trauma, except one person being stabbed, right? So smelling of blood, there's not a lot of evidence. Yes, I know they were burned, but the only one that was actually burned through, most of them, I think, were led to believe, at least the kids and the woman, died of
poisoning, mushroom
poison. Died of the poisoning, yeah. So, unfortunately, Rollo's scent is taken by the wind to the mules. And there you go. Topsy-turvy, pistols are out and they're shot. And Ian is hit in the head and falls. Now, don't qualify anything. I'm not going to qualify anything. I am just saying what Diana wrote. Pistols are shot. And he is hit in the head and falls. We do not know what hit him at this moment. So let's not guess.
No, it says, yeah, it just says something struck him.
Yes.
Something struck him in the head and he fell headlong. And I would like to point out that Diana used the word Clish McClaver.
Yes, that's awesome. I love that. I love that. I love those Scots words. And then he commands Rollo, to run. And he doesn't want to go at first, but then he does, as trained. And then young Ian burrows himself. He's near a log. He was actually sleeping or napping near a log. Or was he? No, he wasn't napping, right?
He was laying on top of the log, trying to sleep while also questioning God in his brain and staring at the universe and its mighty universeness.
He hasn't gone very far. He burrows himself. He gets back down, or I guess he's felled or hit by something and falls. And then while he's down, he kind of scuttles himself down and burrows closer to the log and covers himself up with leaf mold or something like that, Diana said. But remember, it's dark. Yes, he wants to cover himself up, but he doesn't have to hide too much because no one... you can't see him. However, he wants to hide like the fact that he has a, you know, body and arms and legs so that if someone accidentally runs into him, they won't know that it's like another dude or something.
So what exactly would he not try to cover up? Like what would he not mind them seeing other than his head, his arms and his legs? Is there a part of his body that he would be okay with having exposed from the mud, the muddy?
It's not about seeing because no one will see him. Unless they have a torch and he didn't see anything. But so the darkness will keep him hidden as far as someone seeing him, right? Seeing movement. But if he can cover himself up, which I know it kind of sounds kind of weird, but if he can make his...
He's just camouflaging himself.
Well, he is, but camouflage is typically so you're not seen. It's not so you're not felt. Although I guess you could say that's... It could also be a type of like touch, tactile camouflage. Who knows? But yeah, definitely. So no one can see him, but here's the thing. No one can see him like, say, from far away, right? But he could make things. I did not write it, but there's a line in there somewhere where he could make certain things out. He couldn't see the dudes, but he could make certain things out. Maybe, not the men. But he could make certain things out by whatever ambient light there was. So if someone gets close enough, then you might be able to see that there's a figure there, right? So by him covering himself up, he's able to at least blend his physical form into the leaves a little more so that, number one, he's not seen, obviously, by any ambient light that there is. But also, as is what happens, which is hysterically funny and pretty awesome... As they run up on him, he's not even tripped over. He's literally, someone literally runs him over. But thankfully, they didn't notice him. Now, I doubt it was leaf mold that made them not notice him. It was because it was dark and he wasn't, you know, he was close to the ground and they didn't trip over him, right?
Oh, I think he was pulling a PETA from the Hunger Games.
Oh, summer. Oh, well, if there was a ditch, maybe, but I don't think it didn't say that there was any kind of ditch.
I'm just saying he camouflaged him.
Yeah, but again, it's dark. There's nothing to not see.
We all need a break now and then, but why not keep your brain active while you relax? When you need some me time, Best Fiends is a fun escape from the everyday. There are thousands of fun challenges and cute characters to collect along the way.
You know, now that we've been staying home a lot more and more and more, there have been more opportunities to get in a 5-minute game here and there, or 10 and 20 minute game. And playing with friends can make the gameplay even more fun. I am currently on level 51. And it's very challenging. I mean, some of them are like crazy quick. Some of them take, you know, a few times, and some of them I get so frustrated with, I just stop and I go back the next day. But I try and log in each day to get whatever puzzles or prizes or little extras I get. So while the chance of me actually catching up with Summer is slim, it has been helpful to get tips and tricks from her for different levels when I get stuck.
As I've said before, I am sheltering in place in an area with very limited internet and wireless service. So I love this game because it doesn't require the internet to play. So you don't have to worry if your Wi-Fi access is less than spectacular or if you don't have any cell data. I'm currently on level 580. While that may sound like I've been slowing down with my gameplay, the levels are just getting more challenging and I can't resist a side mission. It's hours of fun right at your fingertips.
Best Fiends has thousands of levels already, with new levels, events, and characters added every month. Best Fiends never gets old and they treat the game like a service for their players.
With over 100 million downloads and tons of 5-star reviews, Best Fiends is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play.
That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. He keeps quiet, though. He doesn't yell out. And that actually is huge, because if someone, well, first of all, something I did not write down, which he writes, is that when because Ian wrote the book. Something Diana writes is that when the person literally ran over him, it knocked the wind out of him. That's unfortunate, but it may have saved his life, right? Because if he had shrieked or had gone like, oh, because someone like hit him, he may have been found by the people who were behind the dude who ran, right? Or his teammates, whoever, his people who were with him. But because the wind is knocked out of him, he can't respond, right? He keeps quiet. He can't yell because he's trying. He doesn't have any air in his lungs. And he is very funny. I thought it was funny anyway. Apparently, earlier, he had asked God for a sign. We don't know what it's for yet. We don't know about that conversation. But he had asked God for a sign for something. And he says at the end of the chapter, quote, "I didn't quite expect you to be so prompt about it, though." Unquote. Elizabeth K. writes, "This is our first glimpse into the fact that Ian doesn't really sleep a whole lot and is struggling. I found it interesting that while the show has been very clear to show Ian not praying with the rest of the family and using, quote, the creator instead of God, here in the book he is having frequent arguments with God. I love how book Ian is such a mix of his Scottish white upbringing and the Mohawk that he became. It makes sense to me that he was old enough when he went to live with a Mohawk that his beliefs and habits from before would not have been completely wiped out, but also that he was quite open and adaptable to the Mohawk way of life just based on what we saw of his spirit and nature from books 3 and 4. I really love his final thought of the chapter. I didn't quite expect you to be so prompt about it, though. While we don't know exactly what he was asking God about, my take based on the chapter is that he's been pondering whether or not he should, or deserves to, go on living, or if everyone wouldn't just be better off if he wasn't around anymore." So that makes me think, it makes sense that that's a question that the Ian at this point in time could ask. I could see that. The only thing is, if that were the quote unquote sign that he asked for, would it mean? Well, I guess you could look at it one of two ways. It could be a sign of, yes, you know, you are my creature and I love you and you're important and you need to be around. I want you around, that kind of thing.
So I'm going to have somebody trample you?
Well, hold on. No, because his life was saved. Not by anybody else, by his own motions. Like, he was, by the hair, I can't, by the skin of his teeth, he was spared just now. Number one, whatever hit him didn't kill him yet. He could have been shot. He doesn't know right now. Number two, he was literally run over. So two times, kind of, you could say his life was saved or whatever. So I could see it from that point of view. But yeah, when I first thought about this maybe a few minutes ago, I was thinking about what you just said. Is like, what? The sign is to have me be almost killed? That maybe I shouldn't be here in this life. I don't know. So it definitely, definitely makes me ponder that a little more.
And that was chapter one. Moving along to chapter two, which I'm sure show watchers will find familiar-ish. It's a little different, but very familiar. From season five, this chapter is entitled Dutch Cabin.
Now, something I meant to say, and I didn't, I forgot to, about chapter one is that he tells Rollo to run, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know where, maybe I did say this, we don't know where he is commanding Rollo to go. So one thing we can take from that, what's unwritten or unsaid, is that if Rollo has a place to go, he can't be very far from it. Like, he can't be, you know, a week's run from somewhere. It's got to be some place where Rollo knows how to get to within a decent amount, you know. I don't know about time, I don't know about distance, but, you know, it's not like he's going from wherever he is to a state away or a colony away, right? It's got to be somewhere that they have been together and multiple times, so that the dog has a memory of it. And I don't think it can be that far away. So that, I think those are things, that clues that we can take from it. Okay, chapter two. March 1773, Kenny Lindsay was out and about. I think he was on his own even. And he's the first one who noticed the flames. And before he saw the flames, or before anyone was told about them, no one on the ridge even knew that this Dutch cabin, this so-called Dutch cabin, even existed. So Kenny Lindsay was out, I think, was he out at nightfall? I think he was out at night or twilight or something like that. But he saw it, and he ran, rode, whatever, to the ridge and got, went to the big house and knocked on the door and said, look, there's been a fire already. I'm sorry. I'm missing a step. Kenny went to the fire, which was already, I guess, it was already going. I don't know how far it was, but evidently it wasn't too dangerous. He pulled out the bodies that he could get to, that he could see before going to the ridge. So that's who lined them up.
So he said, save for the dark coming on. He wouldn't have seen him at all, except for the dark coming on. Had it been daylight, he never would have kent it.
Yeah, that makes sense. So it was either twilight. Yeah, dark coming on means twilight or slightly thereafter. So he noticed him. He went to it. He pulled out the bodies, as many as he could, and then rode to the ridge. And then that's how our people find out about it. And when they arrive, we are with Claire and Jamie, Roger and Bree, and Kenny and Evan Lindsay, and I think and Fergus is there, I remember that, and some more. Remember, young Ian's not here because young Ian is next to a log somewhere. We're guessing, because we're not given a date, right? There's no date in chapter one, right, Sam?
Though, to be fair, that whole scene with Ian could have taken place before he went home, last book.
Well, that's the thing, is we don't know when.
That's what I'm saying. It could have... It doesn't mean it has to be concurrently.
No, absolutely, because there's no date given. Yeah. Well, it doesn't mean it has to be concurrently. My guess is it wouldn't be before he got home. I mean, it could have been. If it was before he went home to the ridge, it would have had to have been a different place, not near the ridge, because he would not have said, because that's not how he arrived, right? How he arrived on the ridge was saving someone's life by arrowing, shooting a boar. And he didn't have Rollo go run to get help, basically pull a lassie, right? So it would have had to have been near the Mohawk village or near some other place that he frequented. But yes, we're not giving any time. We're not giving it a date for that. Giving it a date? Wow. We're not given a date. So we cannot say for sure at this point when it happened. Absolutely. So when our people from the ridge arrive at the cabin, there's a line of bodies at the edge of the forest. It wasn't Native Americans, at least, although I don't think it's 100%. I think it's a good clue that it wasn't Native Americans, but I don't think you can say because someone is not scalped that it wasn't Native Americans. I mean, in general, I think it's a pretty fair assumption or pretty safe assumption, but I don't think it's absolute. But that's what that's what Diana writes. Well, that's what they assume. And there were, a good number of small children. None seem wounded. And then this is all description, but then we get a first person sentence. And so we know that Claire is not only there, but Claire obviously is our only first person narrator in the Outlander series, in the books. They've been dead more than a day, we find out from Claire's narration, because rigor mortis had set in and left. And that tells her because of how long it takes from death to rigor mortis to when it leaves, it's been more than a day. There was a young woman, or the young woman there had leather clogs on. She was tall and they believe had likely fallen into the hearth or into something, but not before she died. So her burns, her like whole head and face and everything, her hair's gone. She's all burnt in the top part of her body, including her head. But that did not cause her death. She was dead before then, Claire believes. And Claire continues to do her sleuthing. And it looks like all the people they have lined up, the woman, the kids, an older woman, seem to have all been dead before the fire started and dead almost at the same time. So there's not hours or a huge number of hours, and definitely not a day apart, because they all have a similar amount of probably honestly pliability in their extremities. Like the rigor mortis has come and gone. We also learn that Brianna is there, and Brianna asks her mom if it were possibly poison. That gets Claire's attention. The smallest girl had a blue tinged face and the corners of her mouth had traces of vomit. And in definitely not in any kind of sense of comedy, but maybe in like some gallows humor way or a sense of gallows humor, she cites the Girl Scout handbook, never eat a strange mushroom. Brianna shows Claire the mushrooms that Roger had found growing nearby. And then Claire jumps on it. She says, oh, those are panther toadstools. Agaricus pantherinus. And of course she knows this. Quote, pantherinus because they kill so swiftly, like a striking cat. Now, would this be an Outlander read-along if I didn't look something up that had to do with an animal or a plant? Of course not.
I mean, it's the first episode.
I mean, I cannot disappoint myself or our listeners. So it was interesting. So I looked up like verbatim, Agaricus pantherinus. I looked it up. I typed it in. I thought, oh, well, there'll be like a Wikipedia. Well, so I read a few, not full pages, but I read a few descriptions of very different things. And what it kept coming up as was Amanita pantherina. And I was like, what? So apparently in North America, it's known as Amanita pantherina. The Agaricus pantherinus is, I don't want to say it's only in Europe or more common in Europe. They are of the same family, basically, and they may even be the same. But that's, when I looked it up, that was what it was called, Amanita pantherina. So the Wikipedia link that I will provide in the show notes is to the article for Amanita pantherina or pantherina. So what it, I'll just read a little bit. The panther cap is an uncommon mushroom found in both deciduous, especially beech, and less frequently coniferous woodland, and rarely meadows throughout Europe, Western Asia in late summer and autumn. So you notice that it hasn't said anything about the Americas. It has also been recorded from South Africa, where it is thought to have been accidentally introduced with trees imported from Europe, and on Vancouver Island in British Columbia, Canada. And then it goes on to talk about, it is a fungus living in root symbiosis with the tree, deriving photosynthesized nutrients from it and providing soil nutrients in return. So Amanita pantherina contains a psychoactive compound, muscimol, but is used as an entheogen. I don't know what that means. Our scientists, our mushroom experts can tell me. An entheogen, much less often than its much more distinguishable relative, Amanita muscaria. So Amanita pantherina, variety of pantherinoides, is considered inedible and possibly poisonous. and possibly poisonous. Blah, blah, blah. That's a lot. So another site that I saw that I have nothing to read from, but that I will include was www.mushroomexpert.com. Now, they don't have an entry for Agaricus pantherinus either, but they do have one for Amanita pantherina. And if you look at it, there is mention of Agaricus pantherinus. So all that. Whew. And that's it. So I will include those two links in the show notes. But the question that the people were asking, or maybe Bree, someone put, was why eat them? Like, why eat these either if you weren't sure they were safe or if you were sure they're poisonous, right? Like, either way, why eat them? And, well, they were seemingly new immigrants. Someone hypothesized, you know, maybe they didn't have a lot of food left. Maybe they were, you know, because their garden was pretty minuscule, the way they described it. But Claire says, at least in her narration, that there was, at this time of year, there was plenty of stuff to forage in the forest if you knew what to look for. Now, if they were new, they might not know that stuff yet. So that could explain it as well. And then, what do you think, Summer? Well, I guess it doesn't matter what we think because Claire kind of tells us. Or someone kind of tells us. Evan Lindsay says to look for the man who built the cabin. And when I first, I don't remember exactly what I thought or felt the first time I read this, but I remember when I, at least most recently, in the last few days, reading this again, like how smart that was, right? Because if everyone they found was a child, a woman, or an elderly woman, someone built this cabin, right? Likely, probably not the women, but the point was whoever built it used tools. And he pointed that it's a very important and good point to make. They could see from the end of some of the timbers that were mostly destroyed by the fire that there were marks of an axe. And there was no metal work there. There were no metal instruments there. And the only metal thing that they saw there was a pot. There was one pot. There were no tools, no knife, no axe. And then I think is it Claire? Someone says, find the man.
Jamie. He said it to Lindsay.
Oh, okay. So Jamie says to him, find the man. And so like Fergus and one of the Lindsay brothers goes out. They go toward the forest and others look, you know, further in the burnt remains, I guess, in the charred remains. And Roger finds the man. And then, meaning the likely the man of the house. And then the other men, Fergus and the Lindsay brothers, find two more. And they were no Dutchmen. And they also looked like they were poisoned by the mushrooms. One of the unknown bodies, like further away from the house, was of a black man. The other one was white. And both were barefoot, but their feet were clean. So the way they described it in that summer, does that make you think that they were likely with the bad guys? They took off and they had eaten some of the shrooms, so they died. And then the people who were with them who hadn't...
No, because one of them was stabbed.
Not the two guys.
Wasn't one of that them was
the
stabbed?
That was the man of the house. He was inside the rubble. They moved his body and a knife falls out. So the two men at the edge of a clearing or out toward the forest, they are one black man, one white man, both barefoot, but their feet were relatively clean, meaning they weren't out walking for weeks and weeks and weeks outdoors. Which means what it made me think of, at least this time around, is that... And tell me if you agree or if you see anything differently or see anything else that I missed. So my guess is whatever the purpose was, right? They were there for whatever reason, probably not nice reasons. The woman, likely the woman, someone made the mushroom something. The woman and her kids ate it and died. And these two men ate it and were trying to get away when they died. And my guess is because obviously the dead can't take off their own shoes, and they probably didn't bury them before they died, that they were taken, the shoes were taken off of the feet of the dead men by the people who were with them in their group.
I mean, that's what she says in the chapter.
Oh, she does? That they were taken off?
Yeah. Because Fergus says, so there were perhaps more men, and when these died, their companions took their shoes and anything else of value.
So, yes, I just regabbled that back
and
all.
Fled.
That all back. So, yeah. So, and that, I never, ever, 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 ever looked at this. Like, this is not new to me, right? Like, we've read this before. We haven't talked about it before, but I've read it before. And everything we just talked about is not new to me. The thing that is new to me is after you saying in chapter one, looking at it through a lens of a group of men or people, likely mostly men, getting away from, you know, making a, they weren't running, but they were traveling and they were not quiet, right? They had mm-hmm. the sound of metal and the mules were laden, heavily laden with stuff. And the fact that they found nothing at this house, I think, looking at it through a new lens, I think there is decent evidence, at least decent indirect evidence that, or I should say circumstantial evidence that could have been the people. That could have been the people. When they were lifting the bodies to bury them, I think, and this is for all the body outside as well as the man on the inside. I'm pretty sure the man was on the inside. When they were lifting the bodies, a knife blade fell out of one of them. He had been stabbed. They bury them, the family together, and the two men in a different grave, I think. And they build a cairn over the grave. And Jamie says a word over the grave, or he's going to say a word over the grave. He has Roger speak, however, because if they were Dutch, they'd be Protestant like him. But it was, although it was true that they were likely Protestant, and yes, it's maybe more fitting, maybe more meaningful, who knows, that someone like Roger do it, it was also kind of pretext. He was just trying to get Roger to speak and practice his voice. So it was a good thing for a good purpose and also ulterior motive. And Book Roger, make no mistake, still does not have full use of his voice. And I gotta tell you, I almost had like no offense to anyone. I mean, the first few times I read it, I am sure I read it all. Oh my gosh. This prayer he has, at least in the ebook, is so long. I was just like, got it. You prayed a lot. Okay, let's go on. I like to pray. I'm not anti-prayer, but when I'm trying to get through something and write my notes, I'm like, I'm not going to take, oh, and line three, he talked about the Virgin Mary. Well, that's not really Protestant, but you know what I mean? I'm not going to, yeah. So, yeah, I didn't.
And of all the like Bible verses or prayers to have memorized, this one seems really intricate.
Long. Can I say long again? Long. It's like two pages of stuff, at least in my little ebook. Jamie and Claire think about the coming fire. Of course, they mean the one that is announced in the Wilmington Gazette, February 3rd, 1776. The one that starts with, quote, "It is with grief that the news is received of the deaths by fire of James Mackenzie, ... unquote. And as the chapter closes out, Claire remembers a really interesting, foreboding / funny, grim motto etched on a tomb of a noble lady that she had seen in the Bewley Priory. It said in Latin, which I'm not going to read, it said, "My turn today, yours tomorrow. Thus passes the glory of the world."
It's dark.
Yeah, just a little bit. And to close us out, Megan P. writes, "This chapter starts us out kind of dark. A picture is painted that is a little disturbing, to say the least. Presumably, the man or husband is killed, so the woman or wife kills herself and her children." Now, I'm assuming, Megan writes, if that is what happened, she felt as if they couldn't survive without the male figure's protection and care. Jamie and the rest of the group are making guesses based on visible evidence and what is right in front of them. They have the two men that don't seem to be a part of the household also dead by what looks like the same poison that killed the women and children. Having read the first chapter, we can assume. Wow, Megan, you and Summer are a lot more smarter than me. Or at least have the same insight as I. Wrong or right, we don't know yet, but it makes sense though to me, but I did not have that. Having read the first chapter, we can assume the group that came upon young Ian may be involved, but don't know for sure. They aren't far from the ridge, so I don't understand why the mom wouldn't seek help instead of committing filicide. As a mom, this goes completely against everything I believe in, so I don't understand how it could have gone down like that. Interesting chapter, and I hope we get more answers.
What if it was just an accidental poisoning? Like, literally, what if she just thought that they were just regular mushrooms and made a big old mushroom stew, and then whatever, you know, and didn't know about it, and then maybe after, you know, hubby's got stabbed or whatever, she's like, let's eat dinner and we'll figure out what we're going to do next. And then, you know, the other people ate it too. I mean, there's no, it's not like, there's nothing that says it happened one way or the other. Diana knows for sure. But it's, I think it's a little more nebulous than that.
I think it is. Yeah, you can read it however you like. But I think it's, however it is, I think it's less, I think that is more nebulous than it is nebulous that the people who ran over or around, oh, literally over, young Ian were seemingly, I think there's, like I said, indirect evidence for them having been involved with this, or at least with the people.
Oh, I'm sure they were involved, at least, definitely involved, and at the very least came across it and took advantage of a situation.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
If nothing else, you know what I mean? There's still so much that we don't know right now. We're two chapters in. I'm sure we'll get more information as we go along. And that was the beginning of part one of A Breath of Snow and Ashes. Join us next week when we will be discussing chapter 3, entitled Keep Your Friends Close. And if you want to find out more about how to join in and be a contributor for our read-along, you can go to www.outlanderpod.com/snow. That's S-N-O-W.
And again, a special thanks to co-producer Linda B. To find out more about how you can support us on Patreon, or to find out more about what this co-producer thing is all about, visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon.
And of course, if you'd like to join us to continue the conversation, you can go to www.outlanderpod.com/group.
Thank you, as always, for listening. As we have started our sixth read-along. I cannot believe that. Whoa. Can you believe that?
I mean, I'm reading it, so I have to.
I know. Yes, I know. Look, Summer, humor a bitch here. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.